I want to do kind of three things, tell you how the task force does its work, tell you what the work says really quickly, and then where we fit in the Accountable Care Act. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force is an independent panel of nationally recognized non-federal experts experienced in primary care, prevention, evidence-based medicine, and research methods. We're a 16-person panel, 8 women and 8 men. All but 3 are physicians. We have 2 advanced practice nurses and 1 behavioral expert. We have OBGYNs, pediatricians, family physicians, internists, and geriatricians. We're charged by Congress to review the scientific evidence for clinical preventive services and develop evidence-based recommendations for the healthcare community. I always start with this slide, which I created over 8 years ago, and it's important to point out that nowhere on the slide does it say secret government death panel. I'm going to go through the process really quickly because I'm always worried it's going to seem a little dry, but the most important thing is to recognize that it is a process, that we try to apply it consistently and transparently, and that we don't just make stuff up, that we really do try to do things based on evidence. So these are the steps in the process where we define the question within an analytic framework, which I'll show you in a minute. Then we get the relevant research, read them, and judge the quality of the studies, and we do that work with an evidence-based practice center. Then we judge the overall body of evidence for the key questions in the framework using a set of critical appraisal questions, which come from usual epidemiologic evidence evaluation, synthesize the body of evidence across key questions, and judge the certainty of net benefit, which is the balance of benefits and harms. Finally, we link magnitude and certainty of net benefit to a letter grade or recommendation statement. I want to point out how often the word judge appears on the slide, because nothing is inherently evidence-based. At each point along the process, some criteria have to be applied, and the evidence or the net benefit has to be judged. And it's important to point that out because it's the reason why there's variation using the exact same evidence based in recommendations, that well-meaning people, good scientists can look at the same data, the same studies, and come up with different recommendation statements. What the task force tries to do is be consistent in how we apply the process. So we do want to define the question in terms of preventive service in a primary care setting, and that's important because we're not writing recommendations for specialists. These are for primary care providers. The outcomes of interest in the setting are within an analytic framework that has this kind of overarching question of direct evidence, and if we can't answer that, indirect evidence. So this is what the framework looks like for a screening test. It starts with persons at risk, and the best study would be a randomized controlled trial of invited versus not invited to screen that then showed that overall there was reduction in morbidity and mortality. The problem is that if that's the only way we got to a recommendation, we would have a very slim portfolio. We don't have a lot of randomized controlled trials on screening tests and preventive services. And so rather than be silent on all the other issues, we've developed this kind of chain of where we can also develop evidence. Is there evidence that screening leads to early detection? I know that should go without saying, but you'd like to make sure there's good evidence. And that treatment either changes morbidity or mortality directly or improves some intermediate outcome that we know is a really good surrogate for reduced morbidity and mortality. And finally, we look at, are there harms that come off from either screening or treatment? So we can balance any improvement in mortality and morbidity against the harms. So that's key question one. I think we already covered this slide. So here are the other key questions that say prevalence of disease in the target group. Does the screening test accurately detect the target condition? Does treatment reduce the incidence of some intermediate or final important health outcome? And then we always ask the question, compared to people detected clinically. Because if you can't show a difference between people detected through screening versus detected through clinical assessment, there's no reason to screen. If there's an intermediate outcome only, is it associated with reduced morbidity and mortality? And then what are the adverse effects? So when we look at study quality, this is kind of basic study design in epidemiology. Good quality study has high internal validity, so little sources of bias. There's good evidence that the randomization worked, there was allocation concealment, there was blinding of outcome assessment. You know, they're all the things that help us know that this is a good quality study. A fair quality, though, would be there could be some minor threats to internal validity, but we still think that the answer is the right answer. It's just not as strong as in good quality. And then finally, poor quality, there are major threats to internal validity, and we can't exclude competing hypotheses. Here are the six critical appraisal questions, which look a lot like how you would assess any body of language. The study's appropriate. Are they high quality? Are they generalizable? And this is really a new area for evidence-based practice, because many of the studies we look at aren't done here. And do we really think a study on breast cancer screening done in Sweden is generalizable to a very diverse, a much more diverse United States population? How many studies have been done, and how large? That says how precise our knowledge is. Are the studies consistent, and are there additional factors that support the conclusion? So every key question, we look at the evidence through these six questions. And then we look across the key questions for the body of evidence. And we judge evidence in either convincing, adequate, or inadequate. Convincing says, boy, there are a lot of studies, they're consistent, they're logical, and they generalize to the United States. Adequate is, well, it's good enough, but it's not convincing. So not all of the six questions might be answered satisfactorily. And then adequate is conflicting or poor quality studies, either taken individually or in aggregate. Then we have to determine this net benefit. Can we estimate the magnitude of benefit? Can we estimate the magnitude of harm? And then we do this balancing act. And this is hard, too, because the currency of benefits may not be the same as harms. So for aspirin use, we're trading off heart attacks with GI bleeds. And the kind of question is, how many GI bleeds make up one heart attack? So those are tough things. So then we have to base judgment through the same questions across the body of evidence. And that gets us to the concept of certainty. So certainty is like the risk of being wrong, the opposite of the risk of being wrong. If I'm highly certain, that's a low risk of being wrong. And what we want to do in our recommendations is not be wrong. So I would also say that we don't want to be wrong in the direction, we want to be conservative. Remember, in screening, we're dealing with asymptomatic people. And it's hard to improve on asymptomatic. That's what we all want to be. And so before we reach out and grab someone and drag them into the healthcare system and do something to them, we need really good evidence. So we want to be highly or moderately certain. Moderate certainty is we're not highly certain, but we can get off the dime. We're convinced enough that we think we can make a recommendation. And low certainty is just insufficient evidence, and you run a high risk of being wrong. Then we use this grid to assign a letter grade. Certainty of net benefit is here, high, moderate, or low. Magnitude of net benefit is here, substantial, moderate, low, and zero or negative. You can only get an A recommendation with a high certainty of a substantial net benefit. Three ways to get a B, which is at least moderate certainty of a moderate net benefit. C is a small net benefit. Now, that doesn't say zero, and it doesn't say it doesn't work. It just says that the harms and benefits are closely matched. And then zero net benefit or net harm are the D's, and I's end up being insufficient evidence. Here's a translation into practice. We say do the A and B's. The C we say recommend against routine use. And we worked on this language, believe it or not, for over a year, talking with focus groups, talking with physicians and other primary care clinicians about implementation, about picking the words that would say, you don't necessarily want to do this for every patient. You're going to have to be a clinician. You're going to have to assess the patient in front of you and tailor the care. And that's the best way to maximize the benefit. So it doesn't say it doesn't work. It really didn't try to say don't do it. It just says don't do it routinely. and think about the patient in front of you. The I statement is a conclusion, not a recommendation, is a call for research. It doesn't mean there's no evidence of effectiveness. It there's no evidence of effectiveness. It doesn't say there's evidence of no effectiveness. Okay? So it means we don't know if it works, not we know it doesn't work. Very important difference. And so there's a possibility of clinically important outcomes. The rest of our review process is to bring the experts in to comment on our recommendations. So the family physicians, pediatricians, obstetrician, gynecologists, internists, the NIH, CDC, CMS, the VA, and the health plans all come together and provide us input. This is where the oncologists and the radiologists and the people are on the committee to help us make the right decision. We also use specialty professional organizations, and we send out work products at different stages for review. And we've just added a public comment period so that anyone can tell us that they don't like what we said, which they like to do. I like to think of the pros of the process as we get a recommendations that the process is transparent, explicit, and protects against the influence of politics, economics, and advocacy. And I think that's a real pro. It gives primary care clinicians a standardized set of recommendations. And what I tell doctors is, if you do these, you know your patients are going to live longer. You absolutely know that. In fact, about half of the deaths in any state in the United States are addressed by the A and B recommendations. So you're working with a lot of potential benefit here. It provides audiences with information that could inform healthcare system delivery using this high bar of evidence. The cons is that our most often used letter grade is an I. Sorry about that. No one likes to say I don't know, especially to a patient. But often it's the right thing. We don't look systematically at patient values or cost and cost effectiveness. It does take us a long time to get through the evidence. And often we find that the studies haven't answered questions of things like periodicity, when to start or stop, or should I treat diverse populations differently. I also point out that in the setting of rare diseases, I mean really rare diseases, it's uncertain how well the process works. So that's the process. Here are the A and B recommendations for average risk adults. I didn't put the pediatricians in because actually ACA uses a different, the Accountable Care Act uses a different standard. It's all of the Bright Futures recommendations are covered under the ACA. So I just did the non-high-risk adults. You see the cancer cluster, which is cervical cancer, the world champion screening test, colorectal cancer, breast cancer, and the different letter grades talk about different starting or stopping times, different ages, different modalities. The cardiovascular cluster, high blood pressure, lipids, obesity, and tobacco counseling, and then the everything else cluster, chlamydia, osteoporosis, depression, and alcohol misuse screening with counseling. So these are the main ones. They fit on one slide, and they address 50% of the deaths in your state. There are a bunch of high-risk ones, just to round out the issue. So for ever smoker, smoking men between 65 and 75, one AAA screening we believe is saves more lives than it harms. Aspirin is for high-risk men and women for cardiovascular events. So it's an interesting additional issue. So how does the task force and PACAT interact? Recommendations that are A and B's will be provided with first dollar coverage. Boy, did this make us popular. What this means is that if you can get an A or B rating, your service will be covered with no out-of-pocket costs. And so we've become everyone's best friend. You'd be amazed at what people say. Isn't this prevention? Well, no. These are the floor, though, for preventive services coverage, and this is really important because you will see people make recommendations that exceed the A and B recommendations, and that's okay. It just needs to be a conscious decision and recognize that you may be dipping down into small benefit or the unknown area. Additional coverage can be recommended and added by Congress or the Secretary of Health. And in fact, that's what happened in mammography. When we gave mammography for women under 50 a C recommendation, it wasn't a coverage decision. It was a realization that there's small net benefit. And Congress said, well, we ought to cover it anyway, which I will tell you every person on the task force agrees with, because we didn't think that shared decision-making should be perturbed by whether or not you had to pay for it. So with that set up for how we get to the recommendations, we're going to turn to the implementation of the recommendations in the healthcare setting.